Can you give us a minute, please? Thank you. Hey, so you fucked me.
I changed my mind, Kendall.
When? When exactly? Because it feels like you fucked me.
It's me. It's mainly me. But you, 3 years ago, you were still in the nut house.
Rehab. Dad, it's called rehab. And I'm in recovery.
I hear you let the guy from the website trash talk you and you just let him come.
It's not a website. And I was being professional.
I hear it played weak. Conflict averse.
I wasn't about to get into a fucking big dick competition, okay?
I hear you bent for him.
What? I what?
I hear you bent for him. And he fucked you.
Well, no, actually.
You know, I know that you've read a lot of books about business management and this and that, but you know what?
What?
Sometimes it is a big dick competition.
Charlemagne had ruled the Franks for almost 50 years, founding an empire that made him the undisputed master of Western Europe. Under his watchful command, the Franks penetrated deep into the continent's interior, spreading Carolingian rule well beyond the former limits of the Roman Empire. There, in the beating heart of Europe, they found themselves in the dark places of the earth. In the unshriven company of tribes, chieftains, and gods that were subjected to a new reality. It was the sort of continent-spanning enterprise not to be repeated in Europe until the distant Napoleonic era, which, together with the Carolingian one, bookends the thousand-year story of the Holy Roman Empire. Because of the achievements of Charlemagne's predecessors, there are those who consider the realization of a Frankish empire inevitable, the obvious conclusion to decades of regional dominance. But the singular fact remains that by the end of Charlemagne's half-century reign, the Frankish realm had doubled in size. All throughout this time, the drums of war beat on, with one dance of death following another in a ballet of blood. Ballet harmonized by administrative and cultural advances that crescendoed with the Carolingian Renaissance, laying down the primitive foundations for feudalism, even as he clutched onto more ancient expressions of authority, Charlemagne attended to the needs of his imperial creation well into his twilight years, lavishing affairs of state with the care and attention of a born patriarch. Though for all his many wives and concubines, the same patriarch was survived by only a single legitimate male heir, Louis I. This heir to Charlemagne is known to posterity by a few different names: Louis the Fair, Louis the Debonair, and most famous of all, Louis the Pious. Only a year prior to his assumption of the throne, his father had crowned him co-emperor and formally designated him as his heir. By then, Louis's legitimate brothers had all died before their time, which streamlined the course of the imperial succession and prevented the realm from being split apart in accord with the principle of partible inheritance enshrined in Salian law, the foundational Frankish legal code still in use hundreds of years after its inception. The only question that now remained was whether Louis would rise to the occasion. And the auspices looked favorable. He had been groomed to rule almost from the hour of his birth, and the very name he was given betokened old-world prestige, its various forms and pronunciations testifying to a heritage both Latin and Germanic. In fact, the name Louis, also referred to in the sources as Ludovicus, was a corruption of Clovis, itself a Latinized form of Germanic Ludwig, making Louis the namesake of the first Merovingian king to unite the Franks. Unlike Clovis, Louis received his crown much earlier in life, when he was just 2 or 3 years old. The crown was given to him by his father, Charlemagne, who named him King of Aquitaine, a region roughly corresponding to the area of southern France and northern Spain. This was part of Charlemagne's entirely novel modus operandi. His realm was vast, and so, in the pursuit of stability, he entrusted entire kingdoms like Aquitaine, Italy, and Francia itself to his legitimate sons. These sub-kings, as they are sometimes called, answered to their father alone, frequently joining him on campaigns, feasts, hunts, and assemblies, and remaining in close correspondence with him when they were apart. They were Charlemagne's eyes and ears, but because of the realities of time and space, they received a wide berth that provided them with ample opportunities to assimilate the arts of warfare and statecraft. Louis got his start particularly early. At the age of only 4, he took up residence at his royal seat in Aquitaine, where he learned what it took to rule, while simultaneously building up local connections and becoming acquainted with various regional customs. This was Charlemagne's equivalent of sending a child to boarding school, though in this case, the schoolhouse was an entire kingdom. On a trip to see his father 4 years later, Louis sported what I like to imagine as the period's equivalent of baggy jeans. That is to say, the loose-fitted breeches popular among his prickly Basque subjects. This was more than a childish act of rebellion, though. In all likelihood, the Basques probably appreciated Louis's adoption of their dress in lieu of the tight-fitted trousers that Franks normally preferred. Yet sartorial diplomacy could not solve everything. Not infrequently, the sub-king of Aquitaine had to resort to force to put down revolts in what was still an untamed part of the Carolingian Empire. This freed up his father and brothers to launch offensives elsewhere, some of which he also took part in. Closer to his home in Aquitaine, Louis spearheaded offensives into the Iberian Peninsula, culminating in his conquest of the city of Barcelona. Charlemagne's own forays into Spain had been comparatively less successful, with his greatest defeat having taken place in the Pyrenees mountain pass of Roncesvalles. In 812 AD, Louis and his army were almost ambushed in the very same passage, but due to the precautions he took, history would not repeat itself. It was at least one occasion where Louis outdid Charlemagne on the battlefield. In addition to that, unlike Charlemagne, literacy came easily to Louis. He had been afforded a lavish education and had ready access to the many scholars drawn to the emperor's court like moths to a flame. This made the prince a more self-examining and thoughtful type, someone who would become known for his deep ruminations about the essence as opposed to the simple exigencies of rulership. But unlike his father, Louis the Pious is not remembered as great. He is considered a good man, but not a great one. For all his many virtues, traditional accounts suggest he lacked something Machiavelli called virtù, the kind of manliness and vitality a ruler needed to get things done. Writing in the Story of Nations series, the appropriately named Louis Sargent put it this way, saying, quote, "Louis the Pious, who is also called the Debonair, presents the melancholy spectacle of a man essentially good by nature, full of lofty intentions, amiable, and magnanimous in private life, yet wanting in vigor and resolution, easily relying on the advice of others, and destitute of the worldly wisdom which would have enabled him to choose his advisors well. Men of his character are numerous in every age. They are doomed to suffer themselves and to bring suffering on others. And when they are born, as Louis was born, to hold the reins of government, their life is apt to be a tragedy." End quote. In other words, the traditional verdict on Louis the Pious is that he was lacking in that winning combination of resolution, worldly wisdom, and animal cunning that figures like Charlemagne and Clovis embodied. And on top of all that, Louis was saddled with a conscience. But it bears repeating that everything I just mentioned is part and parcel of the traditional verdict. Now is the time to let the events of Louis the Pious's reign speak for themselves. That way we can learn the real story behind this reputedly tragic figure, and ultimately come to an understanding about the beginning of the end of the Carolingian Empire. After the 36-year-old Lewis succeeded his father, having made the journey to Aachen in a brisk 13 days, it seemed like the start of a reign that would be vigorous, but also stern and puritanical. The religiously minded Lewis was said to rarely laugh or even smile, with certain portrayals evocative of a character like Stannis Baratheon from Game of Thrones. Although the literary culture and iconography of Lewis's reign drew on the same political models as those of Charlemagne, running the gamut from biblical rulers to Roman emperors to Frankish kings, Lewis was less keen on preserving the pagan texts and idols found in the Palace of Aachen and elsewhere. He seems to have had little to no interest in these vestiges of a polytheistic past, owing to a mix of religious and political reservations. This mindset also informed how he treated his relatives, many of whom were forced into monastic exile. Ostensibly, this was on account of bad behavior, but it likely had more to do with concerns about rival claims to the throne. These concerns even extended to his sisters and nieces so that Lewis could be spared the ambitions of a male marrying into the family. Nor did he stop there, proving himself not above speaking ill of the newly dead. The authors of the magisterial book, The Carolingian World, paint the picture of a ruler that would have made Machiavelli proud, writing, quote, "Lewis's presentation of himself as a moral paragon was directed against not just his sisters, but also his father. Lewis's open criticism of Charlemagne in the early years of his reign was intended to distance his regime from that of his father and to give it a distinct personality. In 814, Misi, imperial inspectors, were sent throughout the empire and, with much fanfare, announced that they had discovered oppression and corruption wherever they looked. Though there is no consensus on the dating, it was arguably around this time that a new version of the Royal Frankish Annals was compiled, in which were included accounts of Charlemagne's military defeats, which had been left judiciously unmentioned while the old emperor was alive. Meanwhile, accusations of sexual licentiousness at Charlemagne's court, implicitly aimed at the unmarried state of both the emperor and his daughters, found expression in highly political vision texts dating from the first decade after his death, one of which depicted the late emperor in purgatory having his genitals gnawed at by a beast. The irony of all this was that the man most responsible for establishing the political significance of the ruler's moral conduct had been none other than Charlemagne himself. Lewis was not as different from his father as he perhaps liked to believe." End quote. We would do well to keep that last sentence in mind as our narrative progresses. While Lewis was still sub-king of Aquitaine, he had initiated a religious reform in close association with a Benedictine monk known as the Second Benedict, who was to have a lasting effect on the course of Christian monasticism. Born a Visigoth named Witica, he became a kind of born-again Benedictine after almost drowning during one of Charlemagne's campaigns, and afterwards renouncing his worldly affairs and possessions. Upon Lewis's ascension to the imperial throne, his monastic reforms in Aquitaine would be extended to the entirety of the Carolingian Empire during a series of religious councils known as the Synods of Aachen. In accordance with the Benedictine rule, this series of proceedings laid down detailed precepts for monastic life and clarified the relationship between the crown and the church. This was more than mere moralizing. Charlemagne had presided over similar proceedings, which collectively facilitated the integration of newly conquered and unproselytized territories, most notably Saxony. It is a testament to this work of religious and cultural integration that in the 10th century, a Catholicized dynasty of Saxon origins would produce 4 Holy Roman emperors. But it was in the midst of these religious councils that an event took place which caused Lewis to dramatically reconsider his priorities. On Holy Thursday, a commemoration of the time that Jesus washed the feet of his disciples, Lewis and his entourage were crossing a wooden passageway that collapsed under their combined weight, nearly bringing the emperor's reign to an abrupt end. This brush with death seems to have caused Lewis to get his affairs in order. Only 3 months later, he issued a succession plan that eventually became known as the Ordinatio Imperii. On paper, it seemed like an elegant solution to the Carolingian dilemma, squaring the Franks' cherished principle of partible inheritance with the new reality of their empire. It laid out the following. Louis, the youngest son, was to be sub-king of Bavaria and the adjoining marches. Pepin, the middle son, was to be sub-king of Aquitaine, as Louis the Pious had been. And lastly, Lothair, the eldest son, was to be co-emperor and heir to the imperial title, directly ruling over whatever lands were left. Furthermore, provisions were made in the event of a premature death in the family. If Louis or Pepin died, then each of them would be succeeded by an eldest son. If either lacked a suitable male heir, then their elder brother Lothair would inherit their kingdom instead. Lothair would be succeeded by his eldest son also, but in the event that he died childless, the people, meaning the aristocracy, were supposed to choose between his two younger sons, Pepin and Louis. Known to history as Louis the German, we will henceforth refer to him by his nickname to better distinguish between him and his father, Louis the Pious. Despite the contingency plans built into the Ordinatio Imperii, it had a couple of issues. The first related to the policy of subkings itself. As we have established, this was a novel and therefore ill-defined formula for imperial rule. Operating as a king of kings worked for Charlemagne due to his enormous prestige, gravitas, and because at the end of the day, he wielded not just imperial, but patriarchal authority. This last point bears repeating. Charlemagne, whose nickname at court was King David, was the father of each subking, and the idea of honoring thy father was by then an ancient and cherished one, dating at least as far back as the Old Testament. All that to say, it is easier and more natural to bend the knee to your father, as opposed to, say, a brother or a cousin. It remained an open question whether in the future, Lothair would be able to keep his brothers Pepin and Louis the German in check. The second issue with the plan was its omission of Louis the Pious's nephew, Bernard, who was at that time sub-king of Italy. Bernard's throne had been vouchsafed to him by Charlemagne himself, who had wrested it from the Lombards. This allowed Bernard to rule in peace, so long as he recognized Louis the Pious as his suzerain. However, such an arrangement was now called into question. Perhaps Bernard was expecting further allotments of land, or the distant prospect of subordination to his cousin Lothair rubbed him the wrong way. In any case, such concerns may have been stoked by an aristocracy dissatisfied with Louis the Pious's rule, and soon a rumor began that Bernard was toying with the idea of rebellion so that he could establish his independence. When this rumor reached the ears of Louis the Pious, he decided to nip the problem in the bud. However, before the emperor's army even arrived in Italy, Bernard crossed the Alps to negotiate, meeting his uncle in Chalons, a city of ancient Roman origins that stands in the eastern part of today's France. After this climactic encounter, Bernard was forced to appear at a show trial in Aachen, where he was found guilty of treason and sentenced to death, his other co-conspirators either tonsured, exiled, or blinded. In what was meant to be an act of clemency, Louis the Pious commuted Bernard's sentence to the last of these punishments, blinding, and the act was duly carried out using a red-hot dagger with a needle-like point. This was a habit of the Byzantine Empire, now co-opted by the Franks. Although it may seem inexplicably cruel, there were reasons for these kinds of reprisals. The long and short of it was that, by blinding somebody, you effectively stripped them of the ability to seize or maintain power, or at the very least, to command an army in battle, often the primary method for doing those things. At the same time, since the frequent alternative to blinding was execution, this act was theoretically the humane thing to do. But only theoretically. Only 2 days after his eyes were plucked out, Bernard died of his injuries all the same. Borrowing the words of Talleyrand to describe an altogether different incident, we can say of Bernard's accidental execution that it was worse than a crime. It was a mistake. Think about the optics for a second. Here was a monarch busily enacting religious reforms and ruminating deeply about the relationship between emperor, pope, and god. And now the same monarch was a kinslayer. Resorting to the same tactic deployed at the start of his reign, Louis had three of his half-brothers, the illegitimate sons of Charlemagne, confined to monasteries, and on no pretext other than a concern about their loyalty to him in the wake of Bernard's murder. Yet by 821 AD, about 8 years into his reign, the emperor dramatically reversed course with an act that had neither precedent nor analogy. To make sense of it, we can turn to Rosamond McKitterick, a leading expert on the period, who said, quote, "In 817 AD, Louis showed no signs of the clemency and mercy for which he is praised by his biographers. But by 821, Louis emerges as a milder and rather more interesting personality, a man with a conscience. Louis then repented of his harshness 4 years before, pardoned many of the conspirators, and restored their possessions. Louis also made a public confession and did public penance for what he had done to his relatives, brothers, nephews, and cousins. The penance was compared with that of the Roman Emperor Theodosius by contemporaries, but Louis's penance this time was in fact voluntary rather than forced upon him. Ambrose had forced Theodosius to do penance. Evidently, by 821, Louis felt his position secure enough to permit him to be magnanimous. Yet the pardon extended to so many distant magnates, in light of subsequent events, was a serious mistake." End quote. Louis's penance happened at Attigny, in one of the imperial residences, some 150 in all, that the Carolingians cycled between. There, Pope Pascal I and a congregation of churchmen and nobles were all present to hear the emperor's plea for forgiveness. This penance played weak, something that Charlemagne probably would have predicted, skeptical as he was of accepting a crown from a pope, much less a chastisement. It is seriously hard to imagine Charlemagne ever being put in such a position, much less willingly subjecting himself to it. For all their similarities, there were clearly some differences between father and son. This is also apparent when one considers Louis's love life. Whereas Charlemagne's wives and concubines are almost too many to count, Louis seems to have been a devoted monogamist, with maybe one or two exceptions. His first wife, who had been keenly involved in matters of state, had died only a few years earlier, and the loss seems to have genuinely affected the emperor. It may even have contributed to his decision to perform the penance at Attigny in the first place, with the debt of the empress being seen as evidence of divine displeasure with his reign. Supposedly, Louis the Pious's advisors only convinced him to remarry after staging an elaborate bride show in the Palace of Aachen, where the realm's most eligible bachelorettes lined up with a chance to win the imperial tiara. Although this was a favored technique among the imperial families of Byzantium and later Moscow, the pageant was the only one of its kind recorded in the entire history of the Carolingians, and its veracity has therefore been called into question. Nonetheless, it's amusing to imagine this unsmiling and dour emperor taking part in the pageantry. Whether it took place or not, Louis the Pious soon found himself married to a beautiful noblewoman named Judith. She was a member of the Welf family, which was influential in the lands of Alemannia in southwestern Germany. It did not take long for Judith to assume an active position at court, just like the last empress had. Gradually, the Welf dynasty became even closer to the Carolingians, with Judith's sister marrying her stepson, Louis the German. In 823 AD, Judith gave birth to a son named Charles, who soon complicated Louis the Pious's succession plan. This is because, only a few years later, arrangements were made to grant the emperor's new son, Charles, the region of Alemannia, his mother's ancestral homeland, originally promised to the emperor's eldest son, Lothair. At this juncture, Lothair ruled as king of Italy, while his brothers Pepin and Louis the German ruled in Aquitaine and Bavaria, respectively. Banding together with a group of disenfranchised aristocrats, Lothair and Pepin conspired against their father and his controversial inner circle. This circle included the Empress Judith and Bernard of Septimania, one of Louis the Pious' chief advisors, whose proximity to the emperor probably inspired a fair degree of jealousy. For his part, Lothair was probably motivated by a desire to become top dog. While Pepin may have been fed up with Louis's attempts to micromanage affairs in Aquitaine, the kingdom he had once ruled personally. In 830 AD, Pepin, with the blessing of his brother Lothair, sprung a sort of trap, capturing his father after his most recent and unsuccessful campaign in Brittany. Judith was also captured, and she was accused of having an affair with Bernard of Septimania, alleged to be the real father of Charles. It was the perfect storm, an alliance of convenience between ambitious sons and scheming nobles. But the burning question is, who was using who? In this instance, it seems like the nobility had pulled the strings, stirring up distrust between a father and his sons to achieve their own selfish ends. However, they would not be successful. Just when victory seemed certain, Louis the Pious gained the upper hand before Lothair could confer with his brothers about what to do with their father. After promising Pepin a greater share of the Empire's territory, his father won him back to his side, and for good measure, he similarly secured the loyalty of Louis the German, who had thus far sat out the rebellion. Within the next few months, Louis the Pious re-established control of the Empire and reunited with Judith, who was found innocent of the charge of adultery leveled against her. Bernard, who had fled to his county seat in Barcelona, was also found innocent, but henceforth the imperial couple kept their distance from him. Now faced with the decision about what to do with his thwarted foes, Louis the Pious adopted a policy of clemency, pardoning his sons along with the rest of the conspirators. It was a largely bloodless victory, secured through the power of patriarchal diplomacy. But the victory was not to last, as the next rebellion broke out only 2 years later, precipitated by a dispute between Louis the Pious and his son Pepin. In his usual way, the emperor decided to act preemptively, mobilizing an army to deal with his unrepentant son, only to receive the news that this time, Louis the German had turned against him as well, having been convinced by his brothers to raise an army of Slavs to assert control over the region of Alemannia. Meanwhile, in Italy, Lothair had already been scheming against his father, and so he inevitably threw his lot in with his brothers. This time, it seemed, Louis the Pious had gone too far. In 833 AD, a coalition spearheaded by Louis the Pious's three eldest sons marched north to confront the emperor on a ferric plain in Alsace. They were joined by Pope Gregory IV, whose election had been unilaterally confirmed by Lothair. Although the Bishop of Rome was ostensibly there to mediate, Lothair's past support meant that he had a horse in the race, which ironically put Louis the Pious, renowned for his devotion to the Christian faith, in danger of excommunication. A tense standoff ensued, and support for the emperor gradually wavered. After waking up one morning, he found that the majority of his followers had defected. Left with no recourse, Louis the Pious capitulated to avoid unnecessary bloodshed. His one condition, that his wife and son's safety be guaranteed by the other side. The coalition duly accepted Louis's one term, placing Judith and Charles under house arrest and hauling the hapless emperor to the city of Soissons. Because of the duplicity that had taken place, the site of this encounter became known as the Field of Lies, the subject of countless legends in centuries to come. Historian Courtney M. Booker recounts one such legend, not entirely dissimilar to other German folktales, drawing on a motif known as Wildejagd. According to Booker, it was believed that, quote, God in his just anger cleaved the bowels of the earth and hurled those who were culpable into its foul depths. For centuries, the guilty, entire battalions of men, clad in iron, slumbered in the vast caverns beneath the plain. But occasionally, At certain hours of the night, these same ancient warriors awoke, rose to the surface, and toured the stretches of the Ochsenfeld in Alsace, led at their vanguard by a certain Prince Charles. Those travelers unlucky enough to have chanced upon this phantom army told of being overcome by their plaintive cries of despair, macabre laments that ceased only upon reaching the outskirts of the haunted plain. End quote. 3 months after this fateful encounter, Louis the Pious was forced to perform a second public act of penance in a Benedictine monastery, the only precedent for such a humiliation ritual being the first occasion, which he had willingly subjected himself to, in front of an audience of clergy and nobles, including his eldest son, Lothair, who had spent the intervening summer months game hunting. Louis the Pious tearfully confessed to a long list of crimes, including violating the succession plan, mistreating his relatives, and disrupting the peace. Presiding over the proceedings was the Archbishop of Reims, who added to the betrayal of the Emperor's sons by virtue of the fact that he had been a trusted advisor and childhood friend to Louis the Pious, only rising as far as he did because of him. Such details serve to highlight just how personal all of this was. Unlike the first rebellion, the second one saw Lothair, Pepin, and Louis the German unite together against their father, taking advantage of a dissatisfied segment of the nobility rather than the other way around. During the trial, the emperor had to answer not only for being a bad father to them, but also a bad son to the omnipresent Charlemagne, to whom he had vowed to protect the very family members he was so on guard against throughout his reign. Besides being a family affair, though, it was also a deeply religious one, overseen by a council of clergymen, including the aforementioned Archbishop of Reims. In fact, the whole ordeal was couched in the language of the Christian faith. The good, the bad, and the ugly sides of rulership were distilled into heavenly virtues and mortal sins, so that this act of penance effectively amounted to a formal abdication of power. Coming on the heels of the Pope's involvement at the Field of Lies, Louis the Pious's penance serves as an example of the Church subordinating the state. Only a mere generation after Charlemagne's coronation in Rome, when the papacy had been wrapped around the emperor's thumb. Assuming the robes of a penitent, Louis the Pious was divested of his imperial raiments and belt of office, singulum militare, which, in the manner of ancient Roman officials, was emblematic of political and military authority. This act marked the moment that the emperor renounced any such authority, vowing to spend the rest of his days in search of salvation for himself and the people he had wronged. Traditionally, the abdication of Louis the Pious is seen as the beginning of the end of the Carolingian Empire, as its definitive crisis. But modern historians are less certain of that designation, mostly because of the plot twist that followed in less than a year. The defining deus ex machina moment of Louis's reign. Although attempts were made to convince the deposed emperor to become a monk, something that would have truly spelled the end of his political career, Louis the Pious held out just long enough for his sons to start squabbling with one another, something he could always count on them to do. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, a loyalist faction consisting of his half-brothers, sister-in-law, and various nobles hatched a scheme to place the rightful emperor back on his throne. As you will recall, Louis the Pious's sister-in-law was married to Louis the German, who was gradually swayed back to his father's side by a combination of his wife's entreaties and his older brother Lothair's attempts to wring concessions from his siblings so as to shore up his authority over them. In a dramatic reversal of fate, Lothair soon found himself with no other choice but to submit to his father, publicly begging his forgiveness on hands and knees. The newly reinstated emperor was not finished yet, though. After being publicly exonerated by his former friend and advisor, the Archbishop of Reims, Louis had him deposed by a council of his peers. Yet when it came to his son's lands and titles, Louis stayed his hand. each son was spared and allowed to continue ruling his respective kingdom. Clearly, Louis was a man who loved his children, perhaps to a fault. Still, over the next few years, the emperor began to show a preference for the youngest of his brood, Charles. As of yet, Charles had been too young to rebel against his father, and he would be the only one of his brothers not to do so in the years to come. Following the death of Pepin, who had ruled in Aquitaine, the nobility of that kingdom expected the throne to pass to his son in turn, Pepin II. This was Louis the Pious's grandson, but he opted to disregard him in favor of Charles, to whom he conferred the crown of Aquitaine. This displeased Lothair, but to satisfy his eldest son and heir, the emperor added to his territories as well. However, he took no such measures in the case of Louis the German, who understandably felt undermined. This led to the final rebellion of Louis the Pious's reign, but because Louis the German acted unilaterally, failing to gain the support of his brothers, it was less serious than the last rebellion. Leading an army into Alemannia, as he had done in the past, the emperor's wayward son was ultimately stymied and forced to return to Bavaria. By now, the embattled Louis the Pious was in his 60s, and much like his overactive father at that age, his health began to decline. In 840 AD, after retiring to an island in the Rhine River near the famous palace at Ingelheim, the emperor passed from this life to the next. Much to the surprise of those who were with him in his final moments, this unsmiling emperor died laughing. His final acts included pardoning Louis the German for his latest transgression and reconfirming Lothair as successor to the imperial throne. Now it would be seen whether the authority of the eldest sibling could approximate that of the father. But that is a story for another time. For now, it's worth reassessing the reign of Louis the Pious. Despite the rebellions that broke out from 829 to 840 AD, set off by the combination of ambitious sons, conspiring aristocrats, and discontented subject populations, a lot of things actually did get done. Although much has been made of the written output of Charlemagne's administration, it equated to only 1/5 of that produced under the reign of Louis the Pious. In total, something like 500 charters, capitularies, and other administrative documents were churned out during this period, an average of 19 per year. Many of these charters were drafted by the Imperial Chancery, a revived Roman-era office that, in this period, came to oversee a legion of scribes writing in the famed Tyronean shorthand. Besides charters, there were the imperial ordinances known as capitularies, which get their name from the capitulae, or chapters that they were subdivided into. These were a holdover from Merovingian times, although the Frankish kings of that era could never have envisioned the scale and scope of these later decrees, which were further distinguished by the elegant use of a Latin script known as Carolingian minuscule. Many capitularies were used to flesh out Louis the Pious's concept of the ministerium, or ministry. This is how he saw his realm. It was to him not merely a Christian empire, but rather the Christian empire. This, in theory, afforded the emperor great power, but also great responsibility, more than he alone could bear. That is why the administration of the Christian empire was conceived as a joint venture between the emperor and the office holders who answer to him, such as the counts, bishops, and missi dominici, meaning envoys of the Lord. This latter office was another Merovingian holdover, and would not survive into the High Middle Ages due to the breakdown of centralized authority. Many of the aforementioned capitularies were used to delineate the responsibilities of these imperial inspectors, who essentially acted as a check on the counts. Within the concept of Louis the Pious's ministerium lurked the seeds of his two acts of penance. By agreeing to share power and linking its exercise to responsibility, it became possible to depose the emperor if he failed in his obligations to God and the Christian faithful. But even if such charges had been leveled at Louis the Pious during his forced act of penance, the truth is that they are unfair. the Emperor took his obligation seriously, and for all the rebellions mounted against him by his sons, he did his solemn best to keep the peace. Because of the Empire's size, this was not an easy task. At various times, Louis the Pious had to contend with the Basques, Bretons, Slavs, Danes, and other frontier groups who his rebellious sons sometimes mobilized against him. Owing to hindsight, the tribal Danes are the best remembered, the founders of the Kingdom of Denmark, or Danish March. At this time, this tribal people did not speak Danish, but Old Norse, like their northern counterparts, the tribal Swedes and Norwegians. Together, they are better known as the dreaded Norsemen, an ethno-linguistic catch-all term for the different tribes and clans of Scandinavia, used interchangeably, if loosely, with the term Viking. Being that the Norse were a Germanic people, there was a distant link between them, the Saxons, and the Franks. Judging from their augmentation of the Danework, a system of defensive fortifications in the modern German state of Schleswig-Holstein, the Norse were on the back foot against the encroachment of Christianity, especially with Charlemagne's conquest of Saxony. In effect, Scandinavia developed into a kind of final holdout for Germanic beliefs and practices, the last of the dark places of Europe. Despite that, or perhaps because of it, the Norse would not go down easy. Before Scandinavia was Christianized, its seafaring inhabitants would become infamous for wreaking havoc across Europe, playing a leading role in the story of the decline and fall of the Carolingian Empire. However, these were still the early chapters of the Viking Age, which we take a passing interest in, chiefly because Louis the Pious' exploits against the Norsemen belie popular perceptions about him and the Vikings alike. After successfully intervening in a Danish power struggle, Louis the Pious enthroned a certain Harald Clack, who accepted baptism at the Carolingian Palace of Ingelheim and allowed Frankish missionaries to make the journey north to gain new converts. One such missionary wrote back home to express his genuine concern about the dog-headed men he might encounter in Denmark. But since it was known that the Danes sowed crops, raised animals, and erected settlements, the abbot writing back to his missionary friend deduced that they must surely have souls, and so were worth saving. This underscores just how little was known about the Danes and other Scandinavian peoples at this time, despite their longtime participation in the North Sea trade that the Franks also actively took part in. But as the Norsemen began to accumulate riches with progressively bloodier methods, they went from irrelevant to infamous. As such, the unprecedented collaboration between Louis the Pious and the Danish King Harald served as a sort of template for future dealings with the Norsemen. The Emperor's inroads with the Danes were compounded by those he made with other frontier peoples who threatened the stability of the realm. By and large, these groups had been conquered under the reign of Charlemagne, but their loyalty required constant reminders about who was in charge. Between having to deal with these groups and his fractious sons, the reign of Louis the Pious confirmed the end of a long period of Frankish expansion, a process that had already begun with the twilight years of Charlemagne. Compared to his father, Louis the Pious ruled in a more sedentary way, not clocking in nearly as many miles or as many military victories. However, maintaining the territorial integrity of the empire until his death was no mean feat. Therefore, it would not be right to reduce Louis the Pious into a mere foil to his colossal father, nor to depict him as a tragic character who doomed the empire by his goodness and indecision. To be sure, moments of goodness and indecision played their part in the story, but at other times, the kaleidoscopic reign of Louis the Pious offers glimpses of a character more in keeping with the Charlemagne or Clovis.
How's the boy doing? Is he getting better?
He's fine. So, look. My thing is, I want out. I think I thought I was a knight on horseback, but yeah, that isn't...
Life's not knights on horseback. It's a number on a piece of paper. It's a fight for a knife in the mud.
I don't know, but I can't do jack shit. So here it is. I want to get a premium payout from the holding, $2 bill, and a chunky asset, and I'm gone. I'm a ghost, divested, off the board, complete disinheritance. Won't even speak of your memorial. We're done.
Well, I need to think about it.
Well, you offered at my birthday, so...
That was for fun.
Dad, we can't do this bullshit forever.
Maybe I want your clothes. You can do the mail. Keep you rattling around.
I can't. I tried, but I thought that I could change things. But I'm not as... There's things you're able to do that I can't, maybe.
Maybe.